a real deal. I shoot your liver out and hand it to you.
All right, Demetrius, raise your hand if you were up until past 4 a.m. last night.
I don't know about past 4. That sounds about right. It was a pretty exciting day. So, but we're here now. So good morning. Good late morning to you, Nate, and to all of our listeners.
Yeah, we are starting up. We are going to have fun today. I've actually had some pretty good responses out of the listeners that they like the less editing kind of format of the podcast, which is good with me because it's a heck of a lot less work for me, which makes a lot more time to do other things, which is fantastic and makes me happy. So I guess unless you're strongly opposed to it, and I find out that there are a bunch of people who reach out and say, hey, go back to the old way, the new way sucks, we're probably gonna end up sticking with this for the most part. And Demetrius, you said you were okay with it, so I think we're okay.
Yeah.
Well, we can start in the beginning by getting our normal shout-outs out of the way. I want to give a huge shout-out to Jeremy Hart and Sarah Schmidt for becoming a podcast Patreons, meaning that they have joined the Patreon program for the podcast. Sarah is a frequenter of my Monday night lessons, and she's been coming actually since the beginning. I think she actually probably has a higher success rate of showing up than anybody else, maybe short of Jason Gibbs. It's probably down to those two as to who shows up the most. And Jeremy Hart is a very loyal listener and a loyal, I guess, supporter of all of the events that I do. And he actually left one of the ratings on iTunes that we read recently, which I didn't know, but he reached out and said that was him. So that's pretty cool. And thank you for joining the Patreon. If you would like to join the Patreons as well and get access to lots of different things, like free swag just for showing up or just for signing up, you also get access to the videos for my Monday night lessons that I do every single week for 3 hours. So 3 hours worth of coaching every single week. And you also get some fun insider tidbits and sneak peeks from time to time where if there's something that I can release to the public, as far as insider knowledge, I do. So usually what that means right now is I will announce to the Patreons things that I'm doing so that you can actually find out sooner than waiting for a poster on Facebook to randomly appear in your newsfeed. So, but there are also things in the past that I've done where I've said, you know, these are going to be an announcement today or blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, it's a little bit of insider news that you also get for, I guess, becoming a Patreon to the podcast. So, yeah, if that's any of that sounds of interest to you, you can always go over to patreon.com/queueitup and you could potentially join in on that if you're interested. All right, we'll move on from there. I just ordered a bunch of hoodies. 50 more hoodies are coming in, most of which are large, extra large, and 2XL. If you would like a hoodie coming up in these soon-to-be colder, more frigid times, please reach out to the podcast or me, and we will get you hooked up with a hoodie. They are pretty cheap. They are $30 plus shipping, which is usually significantly cheaper than what other hoodies are. So it's a pretty good deal. If you would like one, please reach out and let me know. They tend to go pretty quickly, and I don't order them all that often because there's a lot of overhead with those. And yeah, it's just, I don't really want to shell out that much money to just sit on a bunch of hoodies, especially now that I can't take them to events and sell because there are no events. So if you would like a hoodie, please reach out. And of course, I also order t-shirts. So if you would like a t-shirt, please reach out. Other than that, I think that's all we have to get cleared up in the beginning. You don't have any announcements, Demetrius, I'm assuming?
No.
Well, then you can go ahead with your shout out.
All right. I thought about it. I think I've got a shout out to Mad Apple Streaming. You can find them on Facebook, Mad Apple Streaming. So these guys, they run a pool room out in Wisconsin. where I had my first visit here last weekend. It's actually really convenient because it's connected to the hotel. So it's you couldn't really get much closer to it's almost like going to a casino tournament where you can stay right there in the pool room. It's pretty convenient. So the owners, the guy that runs it, now you're going to have to correct me if I'm wrong. It's Kendall. It's pronounced Cook, right? It's just, yes, it's Kendall K-O, Cook. It's K-O-C-H, but it's pronounced Cook. Okay, yep, so Kendall Cook. And then, of course, his son, Mason, who I got a chance. I was in the same group as Mason in the VG10, but I got a chance to meet him in person. And, I mean, I was just really struck by his warmth and how just, you know, when he came over, we talked for just a minute. And it just, certain people, you just really feel warm and like a good feeling talking to them. And it was really cool. So great setup there. And they're doing a lot of pool streams. So they streamed the match I played, and they've been streaming a lot of pool matches. They're running some events, and they're trying to run more. And they've been around a couple of years now, but this is my first visit out there, and it won't be my last. So,
yeah, they actually have a 24-hour streaming, which is kind of neat. They have the cameras going on a couple of their tables, and it's literally streaming to the internet at mattapplestreaming.com all the time, 24/7. So even during the day, if you wanted to watch some pool for whatever reason, you could head over to the website, and if somebody's playing on that table, which they usually do, you'll actually get to watch pool. It might not be gambling or anything like that, but you know, you can still watch some pool, which is kind of neat. Yep. So I will give my shout out, and my shout out's going to go to Mr. Jim Telfer and Jay Lataputi. Those two were extremely pivotal in doing the VG10 as well as the East versus West. And I don't know if I gave them a shout out afterwards as part of this. So even if I did, you get doubled up because those two are the best team, crappy streamer / podcaster could ever ask for. They were awesome from start to finish, and I think it showed up with a lot of the stuff that we did with the VG10. So I wanted to give them a proper shout-out if I didn't, and if I did, then I want to double it up. So there you go. I want to give a shout-out to those two. All right. I guess that's really all we have. We do have a sponsor coming soon. We have our very, very first sponsor to the podcast, which I'm extremely excited for. And I think you're going to be too, once you get to hear what Demetrius and I get to start talking about. It's going to be fantastic. But we can't do that yet because we're not quite ready yet. So, yep, we are going to push that one off. But be excited, everybody. It's going to be fantastic. And get your wallets ready so that you can support these guys so that they'll send us even more money. It'll be awesome. All right. Let's move on, I guess, to the only event that really happened. And this is the first quote-unquote professional tournament that has happened since the Diamond Las Vegas Open. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct.
Yeah, so March, is it March, March 12th, March 14th, somewhere in there, is when they canceled the Predator World 10 ball.
And yeah, they did have... They did have that tournament in Peoria, Illinois. It wasn't an international
yep,
field.
You're right. But that's true. That was a couple weeks ago. That's we can argue semantics on that. I mean, that's kind of just like a top regional event that I think the pros ended up at because there's nothing else in the world.
Right.
The Texas Open is a real event, right? I mean, that you can talk about the Derby City Classic. You can talk about Turning Stones. The International Open, but you know, it's not quite in that top tier of tournaments, but it's snug nice and tightly into that second tier of top U.S. tournaments, I think.
Yeah, I consider it I consider like the U.S. Open and Derby. I consider them kind of the U.S. Open for sure is like an international event, and then like this is kind of like along the lines of a Turning Stone, which is like a national level event where you're going to have a lot of international players. So
yeah, so. Yeah, this went down. This is actually the longest running pool tournament ever. So I think we're going to talk a little bit. We're just going to barely touch the sensitive topic that's surrounding this later on. But I think that there was a lot of pressure by the organizers, the owners, the owners of the tournament, the people who are taking it over. This is their first year with it. And I think there was quite a bit of pressure to make sure that the event happened by January 1st. so that they could keep their longest running tournament streak alive. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not. I suspect that it is, but yes, this is they kept it going, and I believe, if I remember right, I thought it was like 47 was the first time that they had this event. I think if I remember right from listening to the stream, I think 1947 was the first or the last time that I guess the 1946 was the last year that this event didn't take place. So that's a pretty long stretching event.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I guess, of course, did we even say it was the Texas Open? We had to have said it was the Texas Open by now, right?
I think so. Yeah. Texas Open.
Yeah. And this had a one pocket event, which was first. And then it also had a 10 ball event. There was a bunch of mini events. I think there was a ladies event as well. A couple of smaller mini tournaments that went along with it. But for the most part, it was a one pocket and it was a 10 ball event. So we can take it chronologically in order. We can start, obviously, then with the one pocket, which had Roberto Gomez beating Dennis Arcoyo in the finals. Third, fourth place went to Shane Van Boning and Tony Chohan. Fifth through eight goes to Joey Gray, Corey Duell, Billy Thorpe, and Alex Pegulayan. And, I don't know. Let's just give the entire field. 9 through 16 went to Junior Jueco, Rick Moreno, Jeremy Jones, David Henson, Sky Woodward, Josh Roberts, Tommy Tokoff, and Alex Calderon. And then 17 through 32nd, I guess there's some buys in there or something. I don't know. I'm not going to go through those. There's a couple big names, Evan Lunda, Blake Baker. We'll just stop with those. As you can see, the field was absolutely stacked. Roberto Gomez does good to win the event. Maybe the one name, well, really, I mean, there's a few names, but the big, big, big name absent, of course, is glaringly absent, is Chip Compton. I think he was signed up for the event but had to back out. I'm not totally sure why that was the case. Are there any surprises in there for you? Any players you thought overachieved, underachieved?
Well, I'll tell you what. I just think that Gomez winning the finals is a pretty big accomplishment. And, you know, we could talk about how he's playing, but that's a big set. I mean, Dennis, having just come off that win with Shane, that comeback with Shane, Dennis is on top of the world right now in terms of how he's hitting them and how he's feeling. And I mean, I think we're going to see a really, really, really hot Dennis for the next, 1 to 2 years, you know what I mean? And so, I mean, he's been in constant action. He's probably the player that's, alongside with like Filler or something, who's been in the most action since COVID hit. And that match was, I mean, so anyway, just all things considered, now you said the Texas Open was 10 ball, the rotation part of it, but it says, I'm looking at a headline on AZ Billiards that says, or Colin Leaves, no doubt in Texas Open 9 ball event.
It was 9 ball, yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure. So he won the 9 ball, and he got to the finals of the one pocket. So how strong is Dennis playing? And so considering how strong Dennis is playing overall, how engaged and hungry he is right now, so his skill level combined with his hunger combined with the fact that he may be the best one pocket player on the planet, I know it's just a race to five, but man, for those that don't play a lot of one pocket, a race to five is a real set. This is not Derby City race to three. This is a race to five. And I'll tell you, that could be a long set. In fact, I remember back when I was kind of an intermediate level one pocket player, I was learning the game, and I was playing a better one pocket player, pretty strong one pocket player. And I remember feeling this way. If this guy I was playing offered me four games to five for 1,000, I would have had to say no, because even it sounds good, four games to five, but I mean, if you're playing a person that you can't win a shot off of, and if you're playing a person that at some point, it doesn't matter if you're getting four games to five, if you can't win a game. And so that's how I felt playing that person. And, And it was, you know, pretty eye opening. So the point is that a race to 5-1 pocket, it may not sound like a long set, but it's for one pocket, it's a serious set length. And when you're playing a guy like Dennis, trying to win five games off Dennis right now in one pocket, that's a mountain to climb, man. And I just, it's really, really, really impressive that Roberto was able to put it together. It really shows a lot.
Yeah, I actually watched a little bit of this match. I had a small sweat bet on it that somebody offered up, and I decided to take it in the moment, which I still have not gotten paid from that person. I should probably reach out to them and find out. Yeah, I haven't got paid for that. All right, well, I'm gonna have to figure that one out. But anyways, I watched a little bit of it. Dennis was up 4-3, and Roberto won 2 straight. And the final game was actually pretty fascinating. Dennis actually had the rack. He had an opportunity at a bank shot and missed it, I believe, and sold out the entire rack to Roberto. And he actually wasn't able to get out, but he was still able to outmaneuver Dennis. And it just seemed like Dennis was like looking for a reason to lose. It was like the one time I actually saw maybe some nerves not get to his arm and got him shaky, and he made a mistake because of it. But I think it got to his mind.
Right, decision-making part of it. Yeah,
yeah, like his mind looked a little bit cloudy. I didn't think he was making the best decisions, at least not like the Dennis kind of decisions that I'm accustomed to seeing in the one pocket. Generally speaking, I can always see the moves that he makes in the game. But every now and then, I'll see a situation, or Dennis will shoot a shot and be like, what is he? Oh, yeah, that's a great shot. You know, just like the things that Dennis sees that, you know, most players don't see, or at least not the people who don't play it really, really at a high level. And I kind of just like looked at those shots, and I kind of started on that track record, but I never got to the, oh, that's what it is. I just kind of got stuck with, what the heck was that?
Like, you know, you bring up an interesting point. That's one of the things that makes one pocket so fascinating. In nine ball, there are decisions to be made in nine ball and 10 ball, but a lot of the decisions, you know, I mean, it's kind of color by numbers, or kind of, it's already decided for you by the layout of the table. And, you know, I'd say the majority of the decisions are kind of automated in rotation. Whereas in one pocket, there's a lot of decision-making, and there's a lot of subtleties and things to blend, and, you know, balances between aggression and defense and all these different things. And so it's, you get to see a wider range of composure where in 10 ball, if somebody's feeling pressure, they might miss balls, they might hook themselves, but generally speaking, their decision-making doesn't break down too bad. But in one pocket, when somebody's kind of up against it, it's almost like you can see pressure get to people, or you can see the adversity get to people, and it can start looking like they're drunk, where it's like they just start making really erratic decisions, and they can, it can be fascinating the way it plays out. And so it's hard to know when you're watching these great players that can do so much. Sometimes they take on what looks like too much, but they're so good that they can execute so many things, and one pocket definitely favors an offensive style. So it's I agree. I think that's fascinating. And, you know, just kind of see Dennis in the finals, Mr. One Pocket, Mr. Pressure, and kind of see like starting to kind of. What do you think? So and do you think that it's the pressure of being the favorite? I know that when you're the favorite, it puts a lot of pressure on you when you feel like you're supposed to win and you're playing, you know, I don't know. Or do you think it's like a Filipino thing where maybe they have a history or what? Cause Dennis is normally pretty cool. What do you think got to him?
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not totally sure. I watched the match, of course. So, they were joking around a lot. I think those two are pretty close. I mean, anytime you have a fellow countryman in the room, and I guess it was probably, I know Jeffrey DeLuna was there as well, but, you know, you kind of a group by association, right? So it's harder to play against. I think it's a little bit harder to play against your fellow countrymen in a situation like that. It's possible maybe he was just getting a little lazy with it. It was, you know, the nine ball had started by then, I believe, too. So it is also a little bit weird to go back and forth. Given the resume that Dennis Arcoyo has, it's hard for me to want to say like he choked under pressure or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just silly, right? So there's probably a combination of, you know, just playing against. I don't think maybe the better question is, do we think that would have ended up happening against Shane or Corey or, you know, Josh Roberts or something like that? And I don't think it does, probably, because I think a lot of things have to come together for that to happen. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, he's still got the four first. I mean, he's a great player.
Well, and, you know, and to be fair, first of all, you're right. And as much as Dennis plays, I mean, fatigue can play a role, too, when you're going playing multiple events and back-to-back-to-back-to-back. But not to say he's not used to it, but it can still – that doesn't mean he's immune to it. Yeah. But I think the other thing is that playing a great player like Roberto, I mean, he doesn't – it's not like he played bad, right? He didn't, like, dog his brains out. He's just – sometimes in one pocket, you know, one or two bad shots or one or two bad decisions, it may have been costly in a close set. It may have been unusual for Dennis. But we're not talking about a guy that, like, struggled to run an open rack eight times in a row. We're talking about, like, sometimes just two or three loose shots can be the difference. And it doesn't mean he's playing bad. Other than, you know, so much is just he made a couple mistakes. So no big deal.
Yep. So I guess when we went back a little while, and it's kind of hard because Chip Compton obviously wasn't in this tournament, but when we watched Chip and Roberto play, Chip and Roberto play, I kind of thought that Roberto was like the fourth, probably about the fifth or fourth best player in the world at one pocket. And then Chip went and kind of beat him. Not terribly bad, but I mean, he put a good thumping on him. Does winning an event like this change our outlook of the game of one pocket in any sort of major way?
Well, it's interesting because when Chip played him, it was a gambling match. It was a race to, was it 20 or 24, something like
that.
I think
it was 20.
Somewhere in there,
I thought it was 24, but maybe 20 sounds right now that you said that. I don't know.
Either way, the point is that Chip had a really clear game plan, and I think Roberto's style was a little bit like, it just felt like Chip was kind of slow and steady, and Roberto was a little, you know, like in the poker world, they kind of say he's a little leggy, a little loose, aggressive. I know one pocket's going aggressive. I'm not criticizing that style, but it seemed like his aggression was too erratic to keep up with Chip's game management and plus, I mean, not to mention the fact that Chip played solid behind his, you know, so it just seemed like he was up against it. He was, you know, Roberto was kind of up against it. And, I don't know if that changes yet because I think that Chip really showed a strong level of one pocket. And I don't think that we underestimated Roberto in that match. I think Roberto is a great, great top one pocket player. I just think that Chip really showed that it was really impressive. I mean, he's you know, considering where he's at in terms of Fargo rate, in terms of 10 ball, he showed that he could play a really, really, really strong level of one pocket in a gambling match. Now, and we've seen it before, but it was about as good as I've ever seen Chip play one pocket, and it put him in the conversation. Now, that being said, I think it's a matter of time. If they rematch right now, Roberto might be able to get there for sure. But I think it's just a matter of time. Roberto's such a talented player, and he's learning the game quickly, and he's a fierce competitor. And Chip was able to keep the kind of the leash on him in that set. But boy, Roberto is looking strong. So yeah,
he is. I mean, I still think that I want to see him and Chip run back another one pocket match.
Me too. I think that would be so fun. I mean, that was one of the best matches we've seen.
Yeah, I mean, I really would like to see them run that back because I really just feel like Roberto is slightly better than Chip, but I do think I underrate Chip quite a bit. I think that Chip, especially at one pocket, he really is on that not quite elite tier because Dennis, Boosty, and well, I think we can have a conversation about this later on. I think Alex is done, not done in a sense of we're never going to see this guy play again, but done in a sense of like he's basically where Earl is now. You'll see him maybe win a couple regional events here and there, but when was the last time we even saw Alex win a match, like a big match that he was maybe not supposed to win? The memories I have from him is getting the break speed off him by Atlante Kachi, and then getting to, I guess, the one match, he did make it to the final, I believe, 8 in the U.S. Open, I want to say 2 years ago. But that's the last time I can remember him actually playing something and doing well in it.
Well, it's been a little bit, you're right, you know, with Alex, and Alex, listen, for many years, Alex was one of my top, you know, favorite players. Actually, a funny one-liner. I actually played Alex at Derby a year and a half ago, and afterwards, I got my picture taken next to him. Well, Shane had come up to watch the end of our match. We were playing one pocket, so Shane had watched the rest of me and Alex play. And then when I got my picture taken next to Alex, Shane just gave me this, like, eye-roll look, like, really, what a fanboy, really. Like, he was just kind of, like, making fun of me. So I walked over to Shane. I said, hey, man, you know, don't make fun of me. I said, that's my second favorite pool player right there. And Shane, yeah, it was pretty funny. Anyway, so the point is that the last couple of years, I mean, and I think, you know, it's a couple things. You know, he's a little bit older. He's got, you know, wearing the glasses some of the time. He's, you know, he had those epic misses against Jason Shaw in that, was it the Pool Masters or I forget what it was, where he missed that, you know, he had that, I know it's just one shot, right, where he
hit the little baby ball. Cut on the, was it the, yeah, they had to win the nine ball. I was thinking it was a 10 ball, but they don't have 10 ball for that. So, yeah, the baby cut on the nine ball.
Yeah, and then the next year he played Shaw again and lost on the hill again. And then it's just the last few years, you know, and listen, everybody goes through it. We could even say that Shane, to some extent, has kind of gone through it the last few years where he's not the same Shane, in my opinion, as like 2016, 20 and before. Anyway, I think you're right. I think Alex is kind of in that spot where he could have a flashback. He could still play perfect pool. He could beat a set off anybody at any time. He's still rated as high, you know, as most of the European players. I think he's still around 800 Fargo rate. He's still capable of playing, you know, amazing pool at any time. But whether it's stamina, hunger, or whether it's just a little bit of a little bit, maybe his striking and his execution is just not quite as consistent. Somewhere in there, it's just he can still play perfect at any time, but just to string it together and smooth it out to the finals of an event, it just hasn't happened for a long time. And there was a day when it was all Alex all the time. And, you know, and it could, the other thing, to be fair, it might not even be anything with him so much, you know, it might not even be that his game is that far off. But it could just be that with the invasion of and the elevation of pool and the invasion of the Europeans and all that, like it might be that when in Alex in 2008 and 2009 and 2006, you know, the level of competition was stiff, but he was winning all the time. And it could just be that the level of competition is so high that he got beat so many times by, I mean, it's like, how many beatings can you take from unknown 20-year-old European champions before you start kind of losing your confidence and your mojo a little bit? And it could just be that the competition level got so tough that he just kind of lost his rhythm and kind of started struggling getting to the finish line and scratching his head trying to figure out how he used to win. So it's hard to know. I mean, this is all make-believe. I'm a big fan of Alex, but there's no question that the results are he has not been dominant in the last few years.
I think I mean, for my money, he's the most well-rounded pool player. Or I shouldn't even say pool player, cuest of all time. I mean, if you want to take nine ball, eight ball, nine ball, 10 ball, snooker, bank pool, one pocket, billiards, I think if you put all of the greats in a round robin competition and all of these things, I think Alex comes out on top. I've said that before. I think he's the greatest cuest to ever live. With that being said, removing the snooker players, because I mean, I don't know a lot about the snooker players. So, if we just use snooker as like one of the elements of it, that's what I mean by that. Not actually like, well, Ronnie.
And the point is that he has an unbelievable blend of striking. Everything.
Yeah.
He has striking. He has cue ball. He has knowledge. He has composure. You put those four things together and it's like, you've got yourself an all around champion. Yeah.
But maybe the reason I feel like this, back in the, you know, after 2000, really four is when we started seeing him a lot. He was actually in quite a few money matches. I mean, he was kind of Dennis before, or he was kind of Dennis as far as being in action a lot. And the last time I saw him in action was with Eklanti Kaci, and that was kind of a spur of the moment kind of match. I believe they did three out of five. Is it two out of three sets, race to 25 or something like that?
Yeah, nine ball on the spot. Yeah, I bet on Clenty on that match, and it wasn't close. Alex really struggled with the break. And then I think another match that you might be needs to be jogged around the same time. Didn't he play after that? He played Sky on the bar table playing 10 ball.
Yeah, he did. Yep, that's – yeah. So, I completely forgot about that one. So the last time that we actually saw him the last time we really saw him play, he's gotten the breaks beat off of him, and that's really the only time we've seen him play for probably 5 or 6 years. I mean, as far as big money matchups.
Yeah, that's a good point. He used to be, you're right, because back in, like, I remember even 2002, he made the finals of the U.S. Open against Raul Suquet. He was very young. But even at that time, he was considered by many the best money player in the world. So maybe not everybody knew him back then. But, yeah, he was, you know, he's been, he was very, very dominant. And so, yeah, it just goes to show how tough pool is, man, that it's just the, I'll say it again later in a different sense, but where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. It's that you can't just look at a guy's striking and a guy's knowledge. And there's something extra when you look at somebody's game and how it comes together to be super. Like I've talked about Josh Filler and how like it's he exceeded the sum of his parts, where he had a little white magic where he just went beyond what it looks like he should be able to do with his game and got just superhuman results for a few years there. Alex had that kind of extra something. And whatever, so, and it's almost like that's lost. And so it doesn't mean that he hasn't lost anything in his game, but that something where he gets that little extra crack out of it.
Well, I think the perfect representative of that is literally Efren, right? Because Efren, he doesn't cue the balls that well. I mean, he flings his arm around. He's got kind of like the boosty arm motion where he's kind of all over the place. So his mechanics aren't overly sound. I mean, the guy's a shot-making phenom, but his cue ball isn't the tightest cue ball ever. You know, if you made a top 10 list of, like, everybody at individual characteristics that you just talked about, Efren wouldn't be anywhere close, probably, to the top in any of the individual things, short of magic, whatever that means. But the dude, you can make a serious argument that he's the greatest pool player, like 8-ball, 9-ball, 10-ball of any player in history, and I would probably actually make that argument. I think Efren is probably the GOAT.
Yeah, so it just goes to show. So, okay, but we've ran a little far afield, totally fine, but we got to talking about one pocket and Chip and then Roberto. And anyway, so the bottom line, getting back to the tournament, Roberto won, Dennis took second. It was a murderer's row. The top eight players were all great one pocket players. And then in the 9-ball,
I'll just give the payouts quick. Of course, this is just the tournament money. There was another, I think it was over $20,000 in the Calcutta for this. I don't know if that's true. So maybe I shouldn't say that, but I think that's true. And first place for this was $8,450. Second place was $5,000 and third, fourth was $2,000. So pretty decent payday. I guess it's still kind of weird to think that golfers are making $1.4 million in these pool players are going to week-long events where they're battling it out for 8,000. But, you know, that is what it is. That's where we're at in pool. All right, so go ahead. Let's move on to the 9-ball part of it.
So Dennis storms through the 9-ball and snaps it off. I don't have the whole list. I'm just looking at the AZ Billiard article.
Yeah, I got it right here. I can run through it real quick then. The winner, of course, like you said, is Dennis. Billy Thorpe comes through and takes second, beating Jeffrey DeLuna for second, third. Alex Pagulayan gets fourth. Of course, we just had a conversation about him. Shane Van Boning and Sergio Rivas. It's a great tournament for Sergio. Finish fifth, sixth. Sky Woodward and Ernesto Dominguez. That's a pretty good tournament for him, too, showing that he can still play. Tony Choens, Josh Roberts, Robert Flores, and Nick Calder. Dang it. What the heck's this guy's name? They cut off half the names. It's Contreras, I believe. Do you know who I'm talking about?
I don't.
Yeah, Nick Contreras. Noah Contreras. They get 9 through 12. And I guess that's probably as far back as we have to go. Well, whatever. We'll go 17 through 32nd. Randy Stoggs, Blake Baker, Scott Kito, Evan Lunde, something Davis Jr., and Steve Smith.
Hang on, did you say Noah Contreras? Is that what you said? What place did he finish?
9 through 12.
Okay, so I know Noah. He's from Nebraska. I actually played in a team tournament with him one time and down in Iowa somewhere. And I got a chance to meet him. And it's cool. He's gotten quite a bit better. I just looked him up on Fargo Rate. He's 658. But that's, as we know, when players are on the upswing, he's probably playing a bit better than that. So I've heard his name a few times in a few different places. So I'm going to kind of keep my eyes on him. It sounds like he was a really straight shooter. But when we played together, it was probably two to three years ago. And he was playing you know, he was not a top player at the time, and it sounds like he's been playing in a ton of action, working really hard in his game. It sounds like he's coming up a little way, so it's cool to see.
Well, the question was going to be do any players in the top kind of surprise you? I would start with Sergio Rivas. Of course, Sergio can play. He's a guy, very young kid from Wisconsin. I think he's 22 yeah. or 23. He's like a 7'30 Fargo-ish player. So of course he can compete with anybody. If you get to be that high, you can take a set off. You can take a set off of a pro. Of course. I guess 7'30, you are a pro, or you at least have the argument to be a pro. Kind of depends on how you handle yourself. I'm looking at his draw right now, and he had, I don't know the first few players he played, but then he played Mika Immonen, won that match on the hill, beat David Henson. Not totally sure who that is, but then he beat Josh Roberts. On the hill. I mean, that's a pretty good matchup. And then he lost to Dennis 9-5. So, no huge disappointment there. Dennis is a great player, obviously. And then he goes over to the B side and loses his first match there, but to Jeffrey DeLuna. But that was 9-8. So he won two matches on the hill to really great players and then lost one on the hill to a really great player. So that's for my money, I think that's the surprise of the tournament if I'm going to pick one.
Yeah, he's a heck of a player, man, and he's been playing a lot. We've talked about it. He's been in a lot of the tournaments. There was a tournament in Hard Times. We looked at results of the earlier this year, and he was out there making runs and taking sets off players. And it'll be fun to see. He's playing good. So, no real surprises. So, Dennis, just congratulations. I mean, it's going to be really fun to watch who's going to want to play. Now you talked about, maybe we already talked about this, but is there a confirmed rematch with Dennis and Shane or not yet?
I don't think that there's dates for it, but from what I heard, and I haven't heard anything recently, but the day after, I was told that they were eyeing a date actually in November, but I think that I just logistically don't think that that actually works. So I'm guessing that that won't actually happen. And I don't, to be honest, I'm not even sure if it's true. That's just what I heard from a reliable source, though. So I suspect that it was in discussion for a little while, but I don't 100% know that it's true.
Okay.
But it logistically, it just doesn't quite make sense. And I don't think, to be honest, I don't think Jeremy Jones would let it happen.
Oh, yeah.
Because, they got to do the 2-week quarantine. And actually, that starts pretty darn soon for the Moscone Cup.
So. Which, actually, that ties into something that you were going to talk about, the last tidbit about the Texas Open that was worth mentioning. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's not a huge amount of stuff that we can talk about here, right? I mean, we could go on a tangent and find something to talk about, but... What I was going to say is we can move on from this. There's not a whole lot of course, this was all streamed by Pool Action TV, so... it's still the best bargain in pool is a pass to Pool Action TV. You get some of the best tournaments, the best matchups, blah, blah, blah. Just get over there and get yourself a membership. You won't be upset. All right. So, perfect segue that you gave me that I decided to ruin by going off on another tangent. But there was some positive COVID tests from staff after this event. We are not going to talk about the ins and outs of COVID, but what we are going to talk about is it possible to run one of these events, a big event like this that's packed in, and really what we're going to direct it towards is what we decided is Derby City Classic. Is it possible to run one of these and not have COVID basically turn into a spreader out of doing this? We haven't seen any players that I know of test positive yet. It's possible they will. It's possible they won't. Who knows? But what does this actually mean for a tournament like Derby, where you're basically packed into a giant room with 12 to 1,500 other players? Now, I will say this because I do know this on good authority. They are still going ahead with Derby as of right now. Nothing has changed. So anybody out there who was interested in going to Derby or was just wondering, from as of today, they are still planning on doing it. They are just going to be well, I don't know if I should tell this, but from what I understand, there are going to be no spectators. Now, I don't know. There's a lot of time left. That might change. Who knows? But the discussion we'll have real quickly here, real briefly, is do we think that given this new COVID world, that we're going to be able to run events like Derby, and maybe what does the event look like that is possible to be had if there is one? So did you want to go first?
Yeah, well, I'll just share my original thoughts, which is when you were telling me, and I was looking at this on AZ Billiards again about, you know, going forward with Derby and, you know, trying to say no spectators. The only problem with that for, you know, is that for those that don't know, when you go to Derby, you can either buy like a spectator pass, or if you play in the event, then of course, even if you get eliminated, you are in the event, so you get to stick around and watch. Well, as it turns out, it's not a double elimination, it's a buyback. So for players that don't want to buy a spectator pass, they can play in one of the events and only play one round and lose. They don't have to buy back, so they can get in fairly inexpensively as a player. And a lot of players, one of the reasons why the fields are so big, and traditionally it's been around 500 players in the banks and the one pocket, it's such a big field because there's 200 or 300 players that might have just bought spectator passes, but it's like, I'm here. It's cheaper just to play. I might get a, you know, photo op with Alex Bagulayan, and why not? So the problem with saying no spectators is that they're all players anyway. I mean, not all of them, but quite a few of them. And so, and so then it looks like, well, what is it in terms of packed, you know, what kind of room capacities do we have in the past? And I just know that like last year, I was telling you this before the call, if you got called on a match where you had to get to the other side of the room, it could take you 5-10 minutes to get across the room because it is packed bodies like sardines where you have to like kind of like wiggle, wait for people coming the other way to kind of come through the, you know, to try to sneak into that opening. And it's just packed bodies from one end of the room to the other, especially once you get, you know, past the first couple of days and you get the Bigfoot challenge or someone, you know, one pocket matches going. I don't know, man. It just seems like I always wondered how the fire marshal even allowed Derby City. I mean, it's that packed. And so I don't really know that saying no spectators is going to change it to where it's like a spacious auditorium. I don't know that that's ever going to quite happen there.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to know that one. I mean, theoretically speaking, it only takes... let me start by saying this. We're not making a stance on COVID here either way. At the end of the day, I mean, in the U.S., we have this exceptionalism that we don't have to follow rules and we do whatever we want to do. And that's fine, whatever. But it only does take one irresponsible person going in there knowing that they tested positive or were exposed to somebody who was tested positive that takes it into a room that packed and is able to potentially spread to 20, 30, 40, 50 people. And, you know, where does it, there's nowhere really for that air to go in a room that packed. So you're all just recycling the same air all the time. So it's, I just don't see how an event like that can happen, certainly responsibly. I just don't understand how, I think eventually it will be canceled. I just don't see how you can leave it up to the players who, you know, regardless as to whether or not whatever you want to say, it only takes one, like I said, to basically spread to an entire group of hundreds of people possibly. So I just don't see.
I think the only way, and again, we got to be careful how far we go, but I'll just say for me, I think it's a matter of if, you know, what kind of level of risk you're willing to take. I think it's a high risk to go to a tournament like that. But if you're not living with anybody that's, you know, I was going to say endangered, but that's not the word.
The at-risk demographic.
Yeah, at-risk. Yeah. It's, you know, I'm like, we're not a bald eagle here. But if you're living with any endangered bald eagles or at-risk population, you might want to consider that. But I mean, but for me, it's just, you know, I don't know. It's definitely seems more hot in terms of like compared now. I had Derby on my calendar. I'm a little concerned. I was going to kind of wait to see, you know, what, but it does seem like a little speculative. Now, I'll tell you this. I'm going to Turning Stone, and Turning Stone's totally different because Turning Stone, first of all, they don't get nearly as many spectators. Yeah. It's mostly just
as many players. Yeah.
And then you've got a 128-man field. And what's nice about Turning Stone is you go to your match, they've got the, you know, the things are roped off, you got plenty of room, so it's just you and your opponent. And then in between matches, it's right there on the casino, so you can go back to your hotel. So for me to stay in my hotel room, go down for my scheduled match, because I know what my match is going to be, play one opponent, and then report my win and go back to my hotel room. I mean, of course, it's public. You know, there's still a certain amount of, anytime, there's always risk. It's not about eliminating, it's about managing it. But to me, that seems like a manageable risk. That seems like a lower exposure. Derby, I agree with you. You know, I mean, of course, you know, we'll see how things play out. But it's, for me, I'm a little concerned about it. I'm not. In some ways, I'm not hoping that it gets canceled, but that would at least make my decision a lot easier. But even if they go forward with it, it's just really hard to want to put myself in a room packed full of hundreds of people right now. So it's a strange time, and we're trying to feel our way through it. So
yeah, it's Turning Stone. Going to Turning Stone. Your point on that one is a lot easier to do, especially since. The comment you made earlier, it's not hard to play a match and then go back to your hotel room, right? It's a close enough journey that you could, it's a lot easier to manage risk when you only have to be there for, you know, the duration of your match and then you leave. Of course, those high ceilings in the stadium, they also create, I mean, it's not exactly an outdoor, venue, but it's closer to that than a giant ballroom, right? There's a lot more air, of course, to, but anyways, I think we can leave it there. I just don't see how the Derby City can happen. That's not coming from insider news, because I know as of right now that they're doing everything in their power to make sure that it does happen. So I mean I don't know exactly whether or not they're going to continue to do that. I just don't see how it can happen though. So, but I guess we can leave the discussion there.
Pretty good.
Yeah. There's not really anything coming. Normally we go into, you know, what's kind of coming up in pool. There's not really a whole lot that I know of. I know, of course, we're a month away today from actually being done with the Moscone Cup, so that's kind of on the radar. Is there any other events that I'm kind of oblivious to that are happening?
Well, there is going to be there was the one in Peoria, Illinois that happened. There's going to be another tournament in Des Moines next month that I'm probably going to be playing again, assuming that I feel comfortable, but I'm signed up for the one in Des Moines, one pocket, $500 entry, $300 entry, 10 ball. I'll be going down to Des Moines to play in that one.
Yeah. That's quite a ways out still. I guess yeah. I was more or less in the next like week or two.
Nope. Just some turkey.
Yeah. There's no action that I know of either. So maybe we're going into a little bit of a lull with pool. Yeah. Well, we can move on from there then. Of course, if there's anything that I don't know about that anybody else knows about, please, of course, reach out to us and let us know. I can share it out on the podcast page on Facebook. And, yeah, I guess we can move on to our listener question for today, the end of the podcast. This will be a question from Matt Kitzman. And this question is, so I am at what I feel is a middle of the road with my game. I am capable of getting out, some days better than others. When it comes to getting through the plateau, I am a bit lost. My question is, when it is practice time, what drills or practice scenarios are most useful when it comes to developing a better cue ball? So, I don't know. I'll take this one on first, if you don't mind.
Good, good.
So, I guess... There are a lot of ways to skin a cat, figuratively speaking, with this question. Of course, you can do the seemingly Eastern European thing, Russia, Belarus, countries like that, where they just do drills over and over and over and over and over again. And you can develop your cue ball that way. That is, of course, the Fedor Gorse kind of, Niels is doing that a lot now. Even, Darren, when he's not fishing, does that. But there's a lot of players who do that. They just sit there and do drills all day long. And you set up your drills basically that require a tight cue ball. For example, the, you know, Jim Telfer just did the 75 ball challenge that Darren, I think, did and then challenged Jim to do. So you throw 75 balls up on the grid and you got to make them all. And Jim was able to do that. Obviously, that requires a ridiculously tight cue ball. An amateur is not going to be able to do that. Sorry. But you could do drills like that. You could do, you know, you could do wagon wheel type of drills where you're really controlling the line of the cue ball. Not necessarily speed quite as much, but more line. But I guess what I'm getting at here is that's not the way that I do it. That is not the way Francisco Bustamante, Earl Strickland, Johnny Archer, players like that. There's many different ways to do this, and they basically just get in action all the time. You know, I've never seen in my entire life Johnny Archer sit down and do a drill. I've never seen it, ever. And when I talked to him about a month ago, he said he didn't even practice. Like, he never practiced. He went like 6 or 7 years, he said, basically without practicing once. And the idea is you have no time to practice if you're constantly hitting balls. You're constantly in action. You're constantly at tournaments, whatever it is. You're warming up before matches, so I guess that's kind of practice. But really, you're not sitting down on a Wednesday afternoon playing for 6 hours doing drills against the ghost or, you know, actually drills itself. I guess I guess what I'm getting at here ultimately is there's a lot of different ways to get a better cue ball, and all of it involves just playing the game and playing the game with a purpose, not just throwing the balls up there and hitting them around. Cause this is what I do actually when I practice is I have about 35 minutes worth of really good practice where I'm working on a lot of things. And then I just start like, I don't even get down on my shots. I don't, you know, sometimes I'll throw the butt of my cue at a shot instead of, you know, the tip. Because I just get bored really easily. But I can practice against somebody all day long for 6, 7, 8 hours at a time. I just can't do it myself by myself. So just get in action. Get playing the game. Get a practice buddy. Do something and just hit balls. But hit balls with a purpose. Don't just hit balls for the sake of moving in a cue around.
Good. Can you hear me okay? Did my mic do anything?
No, you're good.
Okay. So, yeah, so I've got a comment on that, and then I've got a couple suggestions. So the one thing about, like, Johnny Archer being in action all the time, I've thought about this because I actually made a post on this on AZ Billiards. There was, and I don't think you were dismissing practice at all, but there are some people that on AZ Billiards and in the pool community that kind of sneer at practice, or they sneer at coaching, or they sneer at lessons. And of course, I do my boot camps. And so some people are like, well, you know, a Johnny Archer doesn't do a 3-day boot camp. But the problem, the only way that place breaks down is you're right. If you go on the road full time and you're in action every day and you travel the country playing the best players of the country and the best players of the world and having lunch with those guys and breaking down shots and playing matches with those guys, then you probably are going to get enough feedback from watching other players and talking to other players and working on your game with other players to where, you know, you might not need to sit around and do drills. But that doesn't mean that drills don't have a place for people that aren't doing those things. And so it's almost like a vitamins. You know, if somebody lives on the, you know, on the coast and they eat a lot of seafood, maybe they get certain vitamins, maybe they don't need a vitamin supplement. But if you live in Minnesota and you don't, you know, maybe it makes sense to take a vitamin because you got to get those nutrients somehow. And so, yes, the pros get their practice and cue ball nutrients from different ways, but just because they don't, because they get, have that diet, and they get the nutrients they need, doesn't mean that people that don't have that diet can't benefit from things like coaching and drills. And so I think it's a really poor argument to say, well, Dennis Orcullo didn't learn to do a drill, so therefore there's no value in him. I just don't think that holds. So I think you're right that there is value to be had. As far as developing cue ball, my cautions are there's a lot of things that go into it. I've worked with a lot of students, and some of them don't have the techniques or the knowledge. So you can't practice what you don't know or what you can't execute. So there are people that have knowledge gaps and execution gaps. So you have to know what shots you can hit. You have to know how they work, and you have to have the stroke and tip accuracy to be able to execute those shots, because that's, you know, you can't improve at something if you don't know it exists or if you can't even do it. And so that's a lot of what I do, is identify which shots are critical, and then make sure that the person has the technique and knowledge to shoot those, identifying which shots are the most important and become the most common and the most predictable in terms of cue ball direction and speed, working on those shots, the nuances of those shots, and then learning how to run tables using those types of transitions as opposed to transitions that are lower percentage, harder to control. So there's a lot that I would love to just say, hey, come on out to Minnesota. I know that, you know, we've talked about it. You know, I can't wait because I think I can help. But the so there's a lot. It's a complicated question, but I have one answer. If I could give one answer, here's what it would be. Find a match on YouTube. Find a table run with like 5 or 6 balls where somebody gets to the table with 5, 6, 7 balls on the table and pause it. And then don't watch it. Set up those balls on your table and mark the spots of those balls. And then try to run them out. And if you mess up, try to run them out a different way or try to run them out the same way and try different ways of running that 6-ball run. And play around with that run and spend half your practice session. You don't have to do this your whole practice, but spend a good half hour working on just that run. Work on one transition. If you're, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 or whatever, just work on the 5 all those 6. Try it a few different ways. Figure out what you think is the best one for you. Work on them all. And then once you've kind of figured out, okay, that 6-ball run, here's the way I found that I like to do it the best, or here's what I did, or I couldn't run them out. I didn't know how to do it. Once you've struggled with a little bit, then go back to the video. And press play and see what they did and see how it compares with what you did. And then listen to the commentary and see what the commentators say. And if those players did something that you didn't see or that you don't know how they did it or that you don't feel comfortable with, then go set it up and try to understand how they did what they did and practice that, and then practice that shot until you can run them out the way that they ran them out. And so, again, this has to do with what Nate said. Just don't throw the balls on the table. Problem is, if you throw the balls on the table, and you just play and you're practicing what you already know. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. You move on. But you're not learning new things. And so the question is, how do you learn new things without an opponent, without a mentor, without a coach, without better players to teach you? And it's like, if you just practice what you already know and throw balls on the table and run it. I mean, you might get a little bit better at what you already know. But are you learning new things? Not really. And so that's why if you're trying to find a way to learn new things, the best way to do it is to be in competition with better players. If that's not available, then looking at things, you know, like working with a coach is good. But if you can't do that, then that's where going beyond yourself with that pausing a video, creating a layout, and then listening to the commentary and the see what the players do after you've tried. That's a way to introduce new ideas and new knowledge and new challenges that you wouldn't do if you were just playing on your own.
Yep, well said. I guess to wrap up your argument, if you had to make your argument, if you had to make your argument in 10 words or less, what is it?
Come to Minnesota Pool Boot Camp. No, I'm just kidding. Don't just watch pool passively. Study pool. Pause the video frequently. Ask yourself what you do and make notes of anything that surprises you so that you can actually grow.
Yep. And if I had to consolidate my argument down, I would say, just get in action, just play the game regularly, but play the game in situations that mean something. So don't just hit the balls around for the sake of hitting the balls around. Make yourself accountable to actually hitting the balls. And, you know, something like a Dominic Dunn, I don't think Dom listens to this podcast, but you know, he's a pretty decent friend of mine at this point, I would say. And the dude is constantly in action. And if you're constantly in action, you're constantly having situations where you have to play well to get the cheese, as he likes to call it, you know, you're going to hold your, you have a built-in filter. You know, you're either going to do it and you're going to make money, or you're going to not do it and you're going to lose money. So, I mean, even if you're playing your buddy for $5, or even more humiliatingly, if you want to play your buddy for 5 pushups or 10 pushups or something like that, you're always giving yourself, this is supposed to be really quick and consolidated. All right. You just need to constantly have your eyes on the prize as far as, I guess, playing and, you know, holding yourself accountable while practicing. All right, so I guess that's really it. You had a story you wanted to tell, so why don't you go into story time?
I was going to do an action update onto my match that I played, too. I can keep that pretty brief. So we mentioned, because we told the listeners I'd be playing this match. I went to Wisconsin, Mad Apple, played Jeremy Fetkenhauer, a race to 25-10 ball. And results, I'll just cover it real quick. I ended up winning that match 25-15. It was, in terms of the way the match played out in terms of score, it was kind of a steady tide. You know, I kind of got an early lead. I think I got ahead like 9-4 which so I got a 5-game cushion, and I don't think it ever fell behind below 5 games. I extended from 9-4 to like 12-6. And then by the break, I got to 20-11. So I pretty big lead at that point. And then he made a little rally, started playing good, a little looser, breaking the balls a little bit better. But it was, you know, at that point, that's a pretty big cushion going to 25. And it was just a little bit too little too late. And so ended up winning that match 25-15. So from 20-11, I guess that means, oh, I ended up. Okay. So that's the way it played out in terms of score. And the one thing I've heard a lot from a lot of players, and some people were kind of, you know, there was some different, it wasn't the prettiest match. And one of the things that was going on was until that last break or until the last like 15 games, we really were struggling. We were both struggling with a break shot. For those that saw the VG10, this is nothing new, not my best shot yet. Although I've learned some things from this match, but I'll leave that alone. So we were both struggling with the break shot. So some of the feedback we got was that, you know, people thought that the level of play was kind of a little bit lower than normal. Like they were like, wow, you know, it wasn't explosive. It wasn't raining packages. It didn't look like Jesus Atenzi on Tyler Steyer. That is for sure. But there's a couple things I wanted to say is that, you know, I think people kind of have the wrong idea about how pool works. You know, people see top players at the top of their game and they just think that, you know, it's just raining packages and making everything all the time. That's not always how it goes. And what happens is when you play 10 ball, when you break dry, you know, there are 10 balls on the table. And that is a different game than when you break and make 2 or 3 balls. And so it's just that because it's not, the difference between 8 balls on the table and 10 balls on the table, it's not 20% or 25% more difficult. It's 200% more difficult. I mean, it's because if you look at the number of difficult shots or difficult cue ball transitions with 8 balls on the table, usually there's like 1 difficult transition. Maybe there's none. Maybe there's 1, but it's mostly open shots, open pockets, routine transitions, nothing too tough. Whereas with 10 balls on the table, it's not uncommon to have 5 or 6 problems to deal with. And some of those problems become more and more difficult as you have lanes blocked and, you know, clusters and pockets blocked and just, and so what happens is it's the same game. 10 ball is still 10 ball, but it doesn't play like 10 ball when you're breaking in multiple balls. It just changes the flow of the game. There's not a lot of packages. There's when people are struggling with the break, obviously they're not breaking and making balls, so they can't run a package. But beyond that, just in terms of the layouts and the opportunities they're being presented with. And it's tough and it's pressure. Like when you're in pressure, when you're looking at the 1 ball and you know that the 2 doesn't pass the 3 and that the 5, 6 are laying on the same rail, it just impacts. It's not the same as when you're looking at the 1 ball where, you know, if you can just make this, the rest of the balls are open. When you know that the best thing you're going to be able to do is come with the 1, run up to the 4 ball and play containing safety. It just takes out your enthusiasm. It's hard to get. So it changes the rhythm of the game. It changes the flow of the game. And it turns it into kind of a, it can turn it into kind of a grindy game where the games take longer. It's more fatiguing. Nobody catches a gear. And that impacts your shot making. When you're flowing through racks and running rack after rack, then you get pop in your step and it impacts everything. It impacts everything. And so we're playing a real match. We're playing under pressure. The balls are very difficult and you've got an opponent trying to beat you. The level of play is not going to look the same as when you're breaking effectively. And so when people said that the match wasn't played all that well, I'm like, no, that's actually how pool looks when you're not making balls on the break. That's pretty standard. And then the other thing is that, you know, I've heard some people tell me that like my opponent didn't play all that well. And I kind of think that it's partly what I just talked about. But the other thing is that he was down 5 games or more most of the set, and he wasn't getting a lot of great opportunities, and the opportunities he was getting were funny, and I was, you know, doing enough to. So I kind of looked at it like I kind of felt like that was a noob thing to say. When I've heard a couple people say like, yeah, your opponent didn't play that well. I'm like, yeah, well, it would be like, here's what I said to Josh, my buddy. I was like, you know, it would be like if I was playing a match and I played safety on the 10, like say I got tied up on the 10 ball. So I played a safety and left them end rail to end rail where they didn't have a shot. And then that person missed the 10 and sold out a shot and I made it. For like some noob on the side rail, it'd be like, well, you missed the 10 and then he missed it back. And, you know, like you know, you got lucky. You missed that shot. It's like, well, no, I played a safety. Like I put him in that spot so that he wouldn't make that 10 ball. So I didn't get lucky. He missed. Like that was, it's called a safety. Like, what is this? You know, like, so I kind of feel like I played my opponent to where I managed the opportunities at the table. I knew, you know, I felt a sense of urgency on certain opportunities at the table where if I knew if I could win certain racks, for example, there's two things I really think are big. One is maintaining a little bit of a lead. Obviously that's your goal, is to win as many games as possible. But I know that having a lead all day takes a toll on somebody. And I know that when they're down 6-7 games, it's going to be hard to play with the same free stroke confidence as when you're even in the match. And I knew going into this match, I didn't know if I could achieve a lead, but I knew going into this match that I really, really, really wanted to get a 5-game lead ASAP. And I really, really, really wanted to extend it to as close to 10 games as I could ASAP. Not obviously that seems like an obvious game plan, but I felt like for the nature of how difficult that match was going to be for me, it would be a totally different set of, in terms of difficulty, in terms of opposition, if I could get 5 to 10 games up versus if it was a dogfight the whole way. I knew that he would play way, way better if it was a close match. And so I really died trying to get that lead. And I earned the right to have him be a little frustrated, a little off his game by getting that lead. And the other part about that was I was talking about, oh, just in terms of game management, the one big thing is when he did make mistakes and left me, you know, 3 and 4 ball runs, like once in a while he'd miss a 7 or an 8 ball. And I know from a lot of gambling matches, you can't give those opportunities back. And it's a little bit sharky, by the way. And it's not okay. He's not a shark in any way, but what happens, he's a very professional. He handled it like a champ. He's a great player. But what happens a lot of times is say somebody hangs up a 7 ball. Okay. Now the 7 ball is deep in the jaws of the corner where it's hard to make it and get good control of the cue ball. Cause maybe it's deep in the jaws and it's at a funny angle and the cue ball's up table. It's hard to make an accurate hit. And the 8 ball is laying in a funny spot on, you know, where it's also hard to get from the 8 to the 9. So here you've got 7, 8, 9, 10. Your opponent hung the 7 ball. All the balls are open. They're walking back to the table and cursing and like acting like they just lost the game. It's really easy in that spot to kind of like not get out there because the balls like, oh, it's all open. The balls look all open. The 7's hanging. Everything's open. He's acting like he just lost. I should be able to run these balls out. But let me tell you, it's really easy to get funny on the 8 and give and rattle one out and give one back once in a while. And there's nothing that pours gas on the fire of your opponent faster than letting them hang a 7 or 8 ball and giving it back to them. You do that once, and then all of a sudden they get that game back and they're like, wow, I got away with that. It's a breath of fresh air. Your opponent's showing some weakness. It pumps you back up. And I'll tell you what I did. If you go back and watch that match, it's on the stream. I never gave one back. Like I didn't. I made sure, and they weren't all easy. I know it sounds easy, 3-4 ball runs, but I made sure that I put those racks away. I didn't lose the moment when he was acting like the game was already over. I didn't get ahead of myself. I took those seriously. I made sure I got through them. I did what I needed to do. And so to me, I game managed really, really well in terms of score, in terms of converting what I needed to convert. And I nailed down all the shots I needed to nail down to make sure that I executed my game plan in terms of score so that the outcome was not really ever in doubt and that there was all of the pressure was on him. And given the way the balls were breaking and the way that I was refusing to give back opportunities, it would have been really, really tough for him to play well and come back or that's it. And so I'm not suggesting that I could beat him every time or anything like that. He's a great player. It did not have to go that way, but I don't think it was a poorly played set. I don't think I got lucky that he played bad. I think that I managed the game really well, that it wasn't explosive. I wasn't raining packages, but there's a reason it went down the way it did. And that's what happened. So I didn't feel like proud of that set. I mean, it's a set of pool. It was just, it wasn't the prettiest set. It wasn't the best played set, but I think that's a lot of times that's how pool is won and lost, is game management. And I mean, those are the things that's kind of my, just kind of ABC. I'm not a guy that can run 25 racks an hour, but I just try to do what needs to be done to get the job done. And in that sense, I feel satisfied. So.
Yep. You said you wanted a little bit of time. You ended up ranting for forever. Not, I'm just kidding. You had a story you wanted to tell.
Okay, yeah. So thanks for letting me share. So that was a fun match, and you know, he's a tough player, and I will tell you, we're gonna see a lot more of him. He's yeah. Okay. So here's a fun one. I don't think I've told this one, but there's a little moral at the end of the story. So I posted this story on AZ Billiards. It's about a Scotch doubles match that I played. So my buddy Josh and I were out in Vegas, and we were playing Scotch doubles. We'd like to play Scotch doubles because if we played against each other, it could end our friendship. We just don't want to play against each other. We're too competitive. So we were playing Scotch doubles, and the room owner out there was a guy named Gary. And he had a partner, a young guy, and he asked us if we wanted to play some Scotch doubles for money. And so I looked at Josh, and I'm like, snap call. Like, we love playing Scotch doubles for money. So that's fun. So we get in the ring, and we play races to nine. And it's me and Josh against Gary and his partner, who's a younger guy. And so we flip the coin, and in the first set, they beat us 9-2. And the way it went down, the younger guy was probably like 19. He didn't do anything all that great, but he was just like a freewheeling hot shot, but he shot straight, and he shot in all the balls that needed to be shot in. And so he was playing as good as he needed to, because here's the thing. Gary, his partner, played like Roberto Gomez. It was like boosty. It was like a brilliant set. He did everything right. So I'm talking offense. I'm talking defense. I'm talking power and finesse, knowledge and execution, firing and balls off the end rail, making billiard shots on the cue ball, and playing lock up frozen safeties, multiple rails, controlling his speed control, his cue ball, his spin, his power. It was just his shot making. Everything was just perfect, perfect, perfect. It was like watching Gomez. It was like watching, you know, it was just stunning. And meanwhile, his partner wasn't playing perfect, but his partner was not missing. And then coming with, you know, firing in every shot that had to be fired in. So when you partnered up this young partner with Gary, as good as he was playing, between the two of them, they played a phenomenal set of pool, of the likes of which, I mean, they ran us over 9-2. It wasn't even, there was no crack at the door to even win a game. And when we got done with that set, we were just shell-shocked. And Josh and I looked at each other, and we immediately thought the same thing, which is, well, we have to play a second set, because there's no way in the world they could do that again. I mean, like, nobody can play that good again. I mean, it's just, you know, if they could do that twice, we know who these guys were. They'd be world champions. So we flip the coin, and we play another set. And looking back, it's weird. I felt like I dogged it, and Josh kind of carried me. But Josh kind of felt like he was dogging it, and I carried him. So the fact is, we both probably played patchy, but okay. And somehow, some way, they still played good, but somehow things just kind of went our way, and we ended up getting ahead 8-5. And at 8-5, they had a little run out to kind of go 8-6. And they were running the balls out, and the younger guy missed a five ball. That was pretty routine. And so we ended up winning that game and winning that set 9-5. So now we're even. We flip the coin for the play of the third set. But as we're getting ready to rack the balls for the third set, Gary says to his younger partner, he says to the younger guy, he's raging. And he's pissed off for losing that set. And you can tell he's just frustrated. And he walks by and he says with just total contempt, "Can't be missing that five ball, bro." And it was just so much disdain in his voice. "Can't be missing that five ball, bro." He says that to his partner. And I looked at Josh, and Josh looked at me, and we kind of gave each other the bushy eyebrows, like, ooh, this is interesting. Because you probably know what happens next, right, Nate?
Yep.
So we start playing, and his younger partner just starts melting down. He starts trying really, really hard, putting tons of pressure on himself. He's trying harder than he was trying before. He's fighting harder than he was fighting before, but he's too tense and everything's rattling out. And he's just snake bit. And then, just to put the icing on the cake, and in case you guys can't see, because we're on a podcast, not on a TV, I am smiling from ear to ear right now remembering this. His Gary starts going and melting down in his own way, which, as good as he plays, he started trying to do too much to take the pressure off his partner. So instead of just stopping and playing shape for the corner, he's going to try to power draw to give his partner an easier shot at the side, because my partner is playing so bad. If I don't leave him a hanger, he's going to screw up. So then Gary starts trying to do too much, and starts missing and rattling out balls and hooking himself, trying to do too much to take the pressure off his partner because he doesn't trust his partner. And it was the most epic meltdown I've ever seen. And Josh and I won two sets in a row and they quit us. And I look back at that and I just, it's just to this day, once in a while, when Josh and I are playing scotch doubles, we'll always, you know, once a session, we'll bust out that can't be missing that five ball, bro. And we'll think back to that and laugh. And so it was just a very fun session. But here's the fun part about this. Here's the moral of the story where I can turn this into almost like a coach's corner type lesson. I posted the story on AZ Billiards. And everybody was like chiding, like, oh, well, you can't do that. If you're going to play scotch doubles, you can't say that to your partner. Of course you can't. That's so terrible. And why would you ever do that? You got to know, you got to be accepting and forgive your partner. And you got to just be a supportive and build them up. And, you know, who would, you know, everybody was so know-it-all about how obviously you shouldn't do that. And so I let that go on for like two pages of people saying, don't do that. Of course you should never do that. And then I kind of challenged them. And here's where I'll challenge everybody listening to. They may know not to do that playing scotch doubles, but how come when they play by themselves, they all do it to themselves? And this is something that it's the, so how come when they miss their five ball, they tell themselves you can't be missing that five ball. They tell it to themselves. And I've seen this, I've played all the players. I've seen enough sample size to know the vast majority of players treat themselves that way. And it doesn't work any better than it worked in that scotch doubles match. So just because, remember, you're your own scotch doubles partner. And it's, you know, inner game of tennis. I know it's a big favorite of yours. It has to do with the relationship between self one and self two. The doer and the teller talks about how most people struggle mentally because of a dysfunctional relationship between the doer and the teller, who's talking to who. And that's exactly what happens. And so I just want you guys to think about that as maybe treat yourself like your old scotch doubles partner and maybe better things will happen.
Yep. That is that's a good takeaway from today's podcast. I think that's a pretty good lesson that can be learned by everybody. And it's a good way to wrap up today's podcast. So Demetrius, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Nate.
And everybody else out there, thanks for tuning in. And we'll be back next week with another pod.
All right. Take care, guys.
Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. If you've liked what you've heard and you want to contribute to the future content that will be made, consider joining the podcast's Patreon at www.patreon.com/queueitup. Becoming a Patreon of the podcast will help to create all of the future content that the podcast will have. Special shout out to Dave Peters, Aaron Taylor, Pete Silsby, Morgan Lupton, Ben Young, Robert Miller, Andy Morse, and Bill Pelham for your generous contributions to the podcast's Patreon. If you ever need any more information on what the Patreon system is or how you can contribute outside of the Patreon, please reach out to the podcast or Nate himself. If you would like to contribute to the podcast for free, consider sharing any podcasts or the podcast page on Facebook itself. Also, leaving a review and a rating if you listen through iTunes. It helps others find the podcast. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Cue It Up podcast.